Genuine scrambled.
Good afternoon, morning, or good evening, and welcome to Channel 85. Nice to have you in our little net. I'm Fred Flam, director of Washed and Unwatched Programming, and co-owner and co-partner with my co-operator, Clark Cable.
Did you know that Republicans are stupid and evil? Stupid.
Coming to you from the great state of Minnesota.
You look great in here, Fred, Chris, Green, Blue.
Welcome to On the Left, a podcast of news and views from a liberal perspective.
Well, yes, indeed. Welcome to another edition of On the Left podcast. This is Michael Carlucci, and I'm here, as usual, along with the big voice, Matthew Seneff, who will be up momentarily. This is week ending 7/31/2010. And as per usual, before we get to Matthew, let's just take a glance, a fleeting glance, at just a few headlines that we have compiled from the week that has just gone by.
A victory or a defeat for the state of Arizona today?
Well, it's a little bump in the road, I believe, and that, until I get my whole arms around it, we don't really exactly know where we're going to go. We knew, regardless of what happened today, of course, that one side or the other side was going to appeal. So this begins the process. This is an injunction. They haven't heard really the merits of the bill. This is just an injunction, a temporary injunction. And our legal team, and I'm sure the United States of America's legal team, will be looking at some of the issues that they're concerned about, and we'll be looking at the issues that we're concerned about, and we'll start down
the state of Arizona gets overruled, ladies and gentlemen. That was Arizona's Governor Jan Brewer commenting on the story I'm about to relate. A dramatic legal showdown between the United States federal government and its 48th state over that state's controversial law came to a head on Wednesday. Of course, the law of which I speak is the draconian Senate Bill 1070, or the Papers, Please Law, which was officially signed into law in late April. But on Wednesday, a federal judge blocked several key parts of Arizona's new immigration law, essentially putting them on hold just mere hours before the overall law was scheduled to take effect. At 12 a.m. this past Thursday, Arizona police officers were to be required by state law to demand the immigration papers of anyone they stopped whom they believed at the time to be illegal immigrants, just by gut instinct and judging by looks alone. At the stroke of midnight on Thursday, legal immigrants would have been required to have their papers on them at all times as proof of their legal status. Well, fortunately, that is no longer in effect, albeit temporarily. The ruling for partial injunction handed down in the early afternoon on Wednesday by U.S. District Judge Susan Bolton on the controversial parts of the law essentially was in agreement with the federal government's view that those provisions of the law go too far. In her 36-page ruling, Judge Bolton calls into question the legality of several provisions. Specifically, number one, the provision that requires police to check the immigration status of anyone they arrest if there is a, quote, reasonable suspicion that said person is in the country illegally, end quote. Number two, the provision in the law that makes it a crime to not have your immigration papers on you. Number three, the provision that would force any person arrested to present proof of residency before being released from jail. Judge Bolton arrived at this ruling because in some cases these provisions are in direct conflict with federal views or infringe on the role of the federal government to control immigration policies. Within her ruling, referring to the provision of police checking the immigration status of everyone arrested, Judge Bolton wrote, quote, requiring Arizona law enforcement officers and agencies to determine the immigration status of every person who is arrested burdens lawfully present aliens because their liberty will be restricted while their status is checked, end quote. Also, when referring to the Papers, Please provision in the new immigration law, the judge wrote, the United States asserts and the court agrees that the federal government has long rejected a system by which aliens' papers are routinely checked. This requirement imposes an unacceptable burden on lawfully present aliens, end quote. Of course, the fight is not over. Arizona, as a state, plans on challenging this ruling through appeals. Oh, and this next part should come as no surprise. Unfortunately, it goes without saying in this day and age of extreme, vile, right-wing, reactionary America. But say it with me, everyone, nonetheless. U.S. Judge Susan Bolton has reportedly received hundreds of threats at her court office following a ruling on Wednesday. Well, even before this draconian over-the-top bill was signed into legitimacy and ultimately became official only this past week, treatment of suspected, well, as the right-wingers like to describe them, illegals. They're not people, did you notice? They're illegals. As well as many innocent people, I guess we can call them innocents, who have been swept up in this storm. While treatment has been harsh and heartless, to say the least, from both the federal as well as the state level, and racism abounds. For an understanding of just how all of this affects real people, I mean the people at the heart of the matter, there is this report.
Making the difficult journey across the U.S. border, but this time it's back to Mexico. Blanca Torre and her 5-year-old grandson Kevin have an entire life packed in the back of their truck. Living in Phoenix, Arizona was already a struggle paying the rent and other bills. Blanca says recently life in Arizona has become impossible.
Se siente el racismo.
You can feel the racism. Many people have already left. There is a lot of fear.
Fear, and for some, like 14-year-old Jaime, sadness. Most of these children at a shelter in the border city of Nogales have been separated from their families.
We are very sad because we've been separated. My family is now thinking about coming back. The law is forcing everyone to abandon what we've accomplished over a long period of time. Now people are so afraid they don't even go out shopping.
According to the U.S. Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, nearly 230,000 Mexicans were deported last year from the U.S. because they were there illegally. News that a federal judge blocked the most controversial parts of the Arizona law did not end fears among protesters in Mexico City.
The decision is temporary. It will delay the law taking effect, but we will keep boycotting and fighting it.
Although key provisions of the Arizona law are not going into effect, these protesters say the lives of thousands of Mexicans have already been affected.
Government institutions and NGOs are still bracing for an influx of people, requesting further assistance to serve meals and to give them shelter and funds to help deportees to get back home. Still, many deportees yearn to go back to the U.S., despite what they say it's growing racism or the dangers they face crossing the desert.
They actually run, from here, and they jump. They actually jump to go to the other side.
Salvador Diaz was stopped for a minor offense in Phoenix after living there for 22 years. Although Mexico is his birthplace, he has never actually lived there.
I came here to a place I don't know. It's different. Low pay, dangerous, and it's a whole different life for me, you know?
What are you going to do?
I haven't thought about that yet. Sometimes I think I want to go across the border. Sometimes I don't. I hear too many stories of people dying in the desert.
He's out of a job, away from his family. His life interrupted like thousands of others, with a future still unknown.
That report filed by Midriana Sanchez of Al Jazeera. Also, in the aftermath of the new anti-immigration law going into effect on Thursday in Arizona, at least 50 people have been arrested across the state during protests against the state's new law. One of the biggest protests occurred in Phoenix outside of the 4th Avenue Jail run by the infamous and nefarious Sheriff Joe Arpaio. You remember him. The rotten bologna sandwich feeding, chain gang pink underwear wearing immigrant parade organizing sheriff from Maricopa County. By the way, he didn't wear pink underwear. Arpaio dressed his immigrant prisoners in pink underwear and then paraded them handcuffed through the streets. Just to clear that up, Carlos Garcia is an organizer with the Puente movement.
We're going to show Joe Arpaio that we're not scared of him. We're going to show the police that we're not scared of him. Some of us are going to be willing to risk arrest. Those people have already done it. Those people are already trained. If you're not one of them, go figure out how you can help out or support them. Those folks have already made that decision, but for right now, we're all going to take on this street. We're all going to be there and show Joe Arpaio we're not scared of him. Show the Obama administration we're not going to stop until he stops the ICE access program and puts Joe Arpaio behind bars.
A number of demonstrators chained themselves to the Phoenix jail, including the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray of the Unitarian Universalist Church.
We're out here standing here saying, not one more. Not one more mother gets pulled away from her children. Not one more grandfather gets pulled away from his children and grandchildren. Not one more student gets denied the opportunity to follow his dreams after his mother and father have sweated in labor for our country.
Now, while the protests against the Arizona anti-immigration law were peaceful, critics of the law have faced direct threats. I told you before about U.S. Judge Susan Bolton reportedly receiving hundreds of threats at her court office following the ruling she made holding back those provisions of the law on Wednesday. Well, Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva had to shut down his district office in Yuma after staffers discovered a bullet had crashed through one of the windows. Well, dear listeners, we are now living in a new era. I myself have been fortunate enough to have been around and politically aware enough to have understood during the advent of the last era, which shook the very foundations of what Dwight Eisenhower described as the military-industrial complex. The older era to which I am referring started with Daniel Ellsberg and the release of the Pentagon Papers and the revelations contained within, which echoed through the decade and beyond. Well, the new era, the one we're bearing witness to right now, the one that will probably, I'm sure, reverberate through the decades to come, the one that started this past week, well, arguably it started a few months back with the release of the U.S. helicopter gunship video dubbed Collateral Murder. Of course, I speak of WikiLeaks with Julian Assange at the helm. Just as earth-shattering, just as establishment-rocking. And thank goodness for both of them. Even though the news they bear, along with the detailed information that they bring to light, well, it's not very comforting, nor is it very reassuring. But much has been said about it this week by officials and by those bearing all political stripes. It's been described in every which way, from nothing to see here, folks, just move along, nothing new, to it's a security threat. And sometimes those two varying opinions being expressed by the same party. I myself like to look at it as empire exposure time once again, and thanks in this day and age to whistleblowers, because the media certainly isn't doing it. They're most of the time in bed with the complex. So to me, it is very valuable. The smooth and pretty cosmetically maintained and familiar skin is being flayed back just slightly for all of us. Slightly, but wide enough to see the inner workings. But no matter how you view this, one thing is for certain. It is one of the biggest leaks in U.S. military history. Let's just take a look at the news item itself. More than 90,000 internal records from U.S. military actions in Afghanistan over the past 6 years have been published by the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. The documents provide a devastating portrait of the war in Afghanistan, revealing how coalition forces have killed hundreds of civilians in previously unreported incidents, how a secret Black Ops Special Forces unit hunts down targets for assassination or detention without trial, how Taliban attacks have soared, and how Pakistan is fueling the insurgency. WikiLeaks made the files available to three newspapers this week, the New York Times, the Guardian of London, and the German weekly Der Spiegel, who all agreed to simultaneously publish their reports last Sunday. The documents, most of them classified as secret, give a blow-by-blow account of the war in Afghanistan between January of 2004 and December 2009. The findings include detailed reports on 144 attacks on civilians by coalition forces, ranging from the shootings of individuals to massive airstrikes resulting in hundreds of casualties, to how a secret Black Ops Special Forces unit named Task Force 373 hunts down targets for assassination or detention without trial. The so-called kill or capture list of senior Taliban and Al-Qaeda figures includes more than 2,000 names, and it is known as JPEL, the Joint Prioritized Effects List. The files also reveal how coalition forces are increasingly using deadly Reaper drones to hunt and kill targets by remote control from a base in Nevada. Independent journalist Stephen Gray recently talked with Julian Assange on Channel 4 in Britain. Here's a portion of that interview.
We have released 91,000 reports about Afghanistan from the United States military. The reports cover the period from 2004 to 2010 in minute detail. They cover essentially all U.S. military operations with the exclusion of some special forces operations and the CIA. It covers each civilian kill, each military kill that has been internally reported, where it happened and when it happened. It is the most comprehensive history of a war to have ever been published during the course of a war.
And how significant is that?
There doesn't seem to be an equivalent disclosure made during the course of a war, during the time where it might have some effect. The nearest equivalent is perhaps the Pentagon Papers released by Daniel Ellsberg in the 70s. That was about 10,000 pages, but already that was about 4 years old by the time it was released.
And how many pages in your report?
There's about 200,000 pages in this material. Pentagon Papers was about 10,000 pages.
What can you tell us about the source of this material? How do you know it's true?
Well, we know from looking at the material, correlating with the public records, speaking to confidential military sources, that this material is true and accurate. As to the specific source, obviously we can't comment.
This 92,000-plus document release is being widely described as the new Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg, perhaps the country's most famous whistleblower who leaked the secret history of the Vietnam War that many are comparing this massive document leak to, appeared on Democracy Now! This week. In the interview with Amy Goodman, he gave his thoughts. Ellsberg spoke from Mexico.
I'm very impressed by the release. It is the first release in 39 years or 40 years since I first gave the Pentagon Papers to the Senate of the scale of the Pentagon Papers, and not the first that it should have been. How many times in those years should there have been the release of thousands of pages showing being lied into a war in Iraq, as in Vietnam, and the nature of the war in Afghanistan. I hope this will inspire, despite the charges brought against Manning under the Universal Code of Military Justice, which is not civilian law, it's not First Amendment law, it's the military law, so he's in deep water here, as I think he expected. But I hope people will not be deterred from realizing that they have the responsibility that, according to the reports we've had of what Manning said in chat logs to the informant, Adrian Lamo, that realize that there is great deception going on, that there is, in Manning's reported words, horrific material, almost criminal, as he put it, which deserve to be in the public domain, that they will consider doing what's been done here, and that is risking their own career and their clearance and even their liberty, maybe for life, in order to save many lives. So whoever did this, and Manning is charged with it, it remains to be seen whether the government can prove a case against him in the particular charges. But in terms of what he's reported to have said to Lamo, I admire very much the spirit in which he did this. He said that he felt the public needed to know this and that he was prepared to go to prison, even for life, he said that, or even to be executed. That's the first person I've heard in 40 years who was in the same state of mind that I was 40 years ago.
Just to clarify, at that time, Ellsberg was referring to Private First Class Bradley Manning, who was in Iraq, and he had said that he released the documents. Manning has been arrested by the military. Later in the week, Amy Goodman interviewed Julian Assange on Democracy Now! By the way, I highly recommend that you go and search out that interview. It was very, very good, as are all the reports from Democracy Now! Last week dealing with this subject. But she specifically asked Assange about Manning. Here's what he had to say about that.
What has come of Bradley Manning, who has been arrested? Is it true that you are trying to raise money for his defense? Was he the source, as he said in his email back and forth, his chatting back and forth, of the video from July 12, 2007, of the U.S. military Apache helicopter opening fire on Iraqi civilians?
Yeah, so in relation to a military source, alleged military source, Bradley Manning, who has been charged with supplying, the charges don't say to us, but supplying to someone the helicopter video showing the killing of two Reuters journalists in Baghdad in July 2007. He is now being held in Kuwait itself, a bit of a problem. Why isn't he being held in the United States? Is it to keep him away from effective legal representation? Is it to keep him away from the press? We're not sure, but there doesn't seem to be any reason why he could not be transferred to the United States. We obviously cannot say whether he is our source. We, in fact, specialize in not knowing the names of our sources. But nonetheless, he is a young man being held in dire circumstances on the allegation that he supplied this material to the press, and we were the initial publisher of that Iraq video. So we are trying to raise money for his legal representation. We have committed $50,000 of our own funds, but if the general public could contribute or other people could contribute, I know that his military counsel would find that of significant value. The lawyers that we have spoken to say that his representation will cost $200,000, assuming that it's a regular sort of trial goes ahead. People can go to bradleymanning.org, where there is a grassroots campaign that his friends and family and some internet activists have become involved to try and support him.
Goodman addressed the subject of this right-wing-born notion that somehow the release of these documents poses a major threat to national security. Assange had a lot to say about that. Here's a little bit of it.
Julian Assange, the charge that you, WikiLeaks releasing these documents is a threat to national security and people on the ground in Afghanistan.
Well, this is a nonsense. First of all, whenever we hear this term threat to national security, what are we talking about? It's time people stopped responding to that question, unless it's well phrased. Do we mean the national security, the security of the entire nation of the United States? It is clearly an obvious nonsense that probably almost any kind of information could be a threat to the the national security of the United States. Now, do we mean threats to a few soldiers in Afghanistan? That is a more reasonable question and a serious one. Well, the material is 7 months old. It doesn't talk about particular movements of soldiers now or any ongoing sort of operation that's going to occur. So it's not of tactical significance, but it is of significance for investigators. It is of significance for understanding the broad sweep of what is happening in Afghanistan.
Goodman later went on to ask Julian Assange about motives, why he and his staff are doing this. I personally love his answer to this. Give it a listen.
And for those who say you're an anti-war campaigner, and so though the documents aren't suspect because they're clearly from the U.S. government, your motives are, what is your response?
We have clearly stated motives, but they are not anti-war motives. We are not pacifists. We are transparency activists who understand that transparent government tends to produce just government, and that is our the sort of modus operandi behind our whole organization, is to get out suppressed information into the public, where the press and the public and our nation's politics can work on it to produce better outcomes.
Good answer. We will be right back on this extended On the Left podcast news segment. Stick around.
There's an epidemic stirring passions in young hearts. Even the old campaigners have got it. Since Coronation Day. But when the street parties sound, I'm going underground to keep the rabid hounds at bay. Oh my, my, this war dance. A patriotic romance. No, we ain't seen nothing like it. Since Coronation Day, oh my, my, my. But when the ticker tape flies and blood is on the rise, you know it's got you in its sway. You've got yourself a war dance. Sensation, keeping Fleet Street wide awake. Everyone wants a slice of the jingoistic cake. And they're resurrecting Churchill and bringing national service back. Fueling power and glory fever makes for a sicker Union Jack. About this war dance. A patriotic romance. And I know all you poets have seen it all before. About the stirring of those young hearts back in the First World War.
Hi, I'm back. By a vote of 308 to 114, last week the House approved spending an additional $37 billion to continue the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. 102 Democrats this time voted against the war funding, highlighting the growing split in the party over President Obama's war plans, because last year just 32 Democrats voted against the war spending. The House vote came just 2 days after the WikiLeaks release of those documents. The BBC reports as many as 45 Afghan civilians perished in a NATO airstrike in Helmand Province on July 23rd. Witnesses told the BBC the attack occurred in daylight as dozens ran for cover from the fighting. In news from Iraq, the Independent of London reports a new medical study has found dramatic increases in infant mortality, cancer, and leukemia in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, which was bombarded by U.S. Marines and subjected to an intense ground assault in the wake of the deaths of a four-member Blackwater team back in 2004. There has been a four-fold increase in all cancers and a 12-fold increase in cancer in children under the age of 14. Infant mortality in the city is more than four times higher than in neighboring Jordan and eight times higher than in Kuwait. The report says that types of cancer are similar to that in the Hiroshima survivors who were exposed to ionized radiation from the bomb and uranium in the fallout. And just as a side note, do yourself a favor and Google the phrase Fallujah, the Hidden Massacre. Or you don't have to use Google. You can use your favorite search engine. It doesn't have to be Googled. But use the phrase Fallujah, the Hidden Massacre. It is, to say the least, an unsettling and disturbing bit of historical data that you won't soon file away. And in other news from Iraq, at least four people have died after a suicide car bomb exploded outside the Baghdad bureau of Al Arabiya television channel. The bomb destroyed the TV station's office. And back here in the Empire, on Tuesday of this week, BP, the oil corporation responsible for one of the biggest, if not the biggest, environmental disaster on record, you know, in case you haven't heard, that massive oil spill wrecking havoc in the Gulf of Mexico over these past three plus months. Well, they reported a $17 billion loss for the last fiscal period, due in part to putting $32 billion aside to pay for the oil disaster itself. The loss, according to outgoing CEO Tony Hayward, allows the company to take a $10 billion corporate tax credit. Yes, you heard me right, folks. A tax credit. That would mean that we, the people, will be fronting half of the $20 billion escrow account set up, wouldn't it? Well, if the Valdez court rulings are any indicator, BP will eventually weasel out of that one as well. But the company and Tony
Mike,
Hayward...
Mike!
What?
Mike. BP is
what?
Fat.
BP is what?
Shh. BP has failed to put anything in the escrow account. They haven't made a deposit yet.
That's quite different.
Just go on. Go on. Go.
And as a matter of fact, the weaseling has already started. BP has failed to put any money in the promised escrow account. In a deal negotiated last month, President Obama and BP officials agreed the company would pay $5 billion annually over the next 4 years into an escrow account to pay for damages its oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico has caused. Ken Feinberg, who was appointed to administer oil spill claims out of the escrow fund, has said that he, quote, hasn't been able to start writing claims checks, end quote, because BP has failed to deposit any money into the $20 billion fund it promised to create. Feinberg went on to say that he does not have the authority to force BP to deposit the money, but his hands are tied until it does. Quote, I don't want the checks to bounce, end quote, he said. The day after the escrow account's establishment in June, BP CEO Tony Hayward told Congress that BP is, and I quote, unwavering in our commitment to fulfill all our responsibilities, end quote, and that the company, quote, won't stop spending until the job is done, end quote. Anyway, that was just a little side note, got a little sidetracked there. Let's get back to Tony and the company. The company also announced the replacement for Hayward, U.S. board member Robert Dudley, the first American to serve in this position. But don't worry about Tony, because I know you all out there are concerned for his well-being. Set your mind at ease. The parachute is now opening for Hayward. He will leave BP with benefits valued at more than $18 million. Now, to many out there paying attention to this sort of thing, this may seem like a modest amount insofar as exiting corporate executive parachutes go. Certainly one of the highest was Robert Nardelli when he left Home Depot, which was valued at about $120 million, and that was after 5 years of underperformance at the right-wing Republican-friendly home improvement chain. Exit packages averaging at around $40 million are pretty standard in U.S. practices. That, according to Paul Hodson, senior research associate at the Corporate Library, which specializes in executive compensation and corporate governance issues. But then again, on the other hand, when you consider the scale of this thing, the sheer size of this environmental disaster for which Tony's company is responsible, when you consider the blundering negligence and the deliberate greed-ridden practices causing the worst oil spill in U.S. history, not to mention the fact that Hayward headed a corporate entity cited by OSHA more than 700 times for safety violations in its U.S. refineries since he took the seat in 2007... Don't you think it's a little excessive? I mean, wouldn't you think that Tony, along with his corporate-friendly enablers in Washington, D.C., deserves some other treatment, something different? And I don't mean anything drastic. I mean something along the lines of a legal procedure being done. Oh, well. I'm sure I won't be the first to use this joke. I'm sure it's already been used since the announcement of Tony's departure from the stage, but I'll say it anyway. It's inevitable. Heck of a job, Tony. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day.
At any rate, to continue this story about Tony Hayward and BP, Tony Hayward told reporters that he had been, quote, demonized and vilified, end quote, in the U.S. press, but had no major regrets about his leadership. Life isn't fair, he said, but he conceded that that wasn't the point. He went on to say that BP could not move on in the U.S. with him as its leader. Meanwhile, the BP oil disaster continues to devastate many on the Gulf Coast, including the Houma Nation. With 17,000 members, this tribe is the largest on the Louisiana coast. Although they have lived there since pre-colonial times, the nation isn't recognized by the federal government. First hit hard by Katrina, the tribe is now contending with the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history. For more, let's turn to Free Speech Radio News correspondent Zoe Sullivan.
Like the rest of the Gulf Coast population, the United Houma Nation faces what could be an end to its sea-based way of life. The Houma have relied on fishing and hunting in the wetlands and on the coast for generations. In more recent times, some have also turned to work in the oil industry. Tribal leaders see the BP oil disaster as the last straw, and maybe the Houma's last stand. Erosion has been eating away at the wetlands for decades, accelerated by canals oil companies dug for shipping. Now oil may destroy fishing beds and hunting grounds, as well as local plant life, all of which form an integral part of the indigenous lifestyle and culture.
We need to take the opportunity to bring our case to the world.
Mike Darter is a member of the United Houma Nation Council.
The spill and the effects of this spill has interrupted that. It's taken away our ability to stay in our homelands. It's taken away our ability to sustain ourselves as we've always known how to do.
Darter says the majority of Houma are having trouble feeding their families because they can no longer work on the water. Losing their livelihoods is just one way the Houma are being hit. Native plants may also be wiped out by oil pollutants, undermining traditional health care remedies for rashes, colics, and colds, as well as materials for indigenous crafts. In the face of these threats, tribal leaders are weighing how to use a human rights framework to call for justice. Kirk Sheremy is a member of the tribe.
Just the fact that the oil spill occurred and the lack of federal regulation having to do with making sure these types of things don't happen, it's cause enough for it to be a human rights violation under the United Nations Human Rights Commission.
Sheremy points out, though, that the U.S. hasn't ratified the U.N.'s Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, bringing into question whether public officials can be held accountable for the disaster's impact on the Houma and other Native people. This isn't the first time oil has damaged Indigenous communities. A delegation from Ecuador came to visit the Houma in early July to share their experiences battling Texaco Chevron over oil contamination. Sheremy says there are similarities between Louisiana and Ecuador.
Everyone around the world looks up to the United States as this rich, powerful, you know, government that is just for the most part. And they were not expecting to find that the regulatory atmosphere for oil and gas here was just like it is in their country. It's heavily controlled by political contributions to politicians and buying off any adversary.
Millions of gallons of oil are still floating in the Gulf and hitting the coastal beaches and marshes. Houma Nation members say they may be forced to evacuate permanently if storms push the oil further inland. Steve Williams is a member of the United Houma Nation Council and a New Orleans-based artist.
I said we're not a federally recognized tribe. We don't have official reservation or anything like that to go, or but we're working on options to do find a safe zone for us to be.
In the face of this, the tribe may find some protection under the United Nations Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement, a document the United States has endorsed. The principles outline how people who are forced to move by disasters should be treated, and it specifically mentions indigenous people and others with a special dependency on their lands. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
That story taken from Free Speech Radio News. Please visit their site at fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. And in more greasy, oily news, yet another spill to report on. In Michigan, more than 800,000 gallons of oil have leaked into the Talamage Creek and Kalamazoo River after the rupture of an underground oil pipe. The spill has been described as one of the worst in the history of the Midwest. The pipeline is owned and operated by the firm Enbridge, based in Calgary, Alberta. Michigan's Governor Jennifer Granholm has sharply criticized the EPA and the Canadian company Enbridge for what she has described as a completely inadequate response to the oil spill near the Kalamazoo River. As I said, more than 800,000 gallons of oil have already spilled into Michigan waterways after this rupture of an underground oil pipe transporting Canadian oil into the United States. Concern is now growing that the oil could reach Lake Michigan. The Detroit Free Press reports that Enbridge was notified twice this year of potential problems involving old pipe prone to rupturing and an inadequate system for monitoring internal corrosion. Meanwhile, yet another spill has been reported in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of, guess where? That's right, Louisiana. Earlier on Tuesday, a barge slammed into an abandoned oil well, causing a shower of water, natural gas, and oil to spew about 100 feet into the air. The accident occurred in Mud Lake, a coastal inlet just north of Louisiana's Barataria Bay, an area that was already under threat from the massive Deepwater Horizon oil spill. According to the U.S. Coast Guard, the tugboat's captain said the well was not lit. The Coast Guard also identified the owner of the well as a Houston-based company called Sodico Corporation. Officials have been unable to make contact with Sodico, and it is now being reported that the company is out of business. And as of record time for this program, it is also being reported that the spill has spread to a 6-square-mile radius on Bayou St. Denis, which is near the Barataria waterway. Crews from a Texas-based company called Wild Well arrived on the scene Wednesday afternoon to begin cleaning up the resulting oil well, but NOLA reports that the broken wellhead located in Lower Jefferson Parish continues to spew at this hour. Efforts to cap the well were underway on Wednesday, and it was originally thought that the spewing wellhead would be capped within a day, but now it would seem the wellhead is not expected to be plugged until sometime next week. More than 27,000 abandoned oil and gas wells lurk in the hard rock beneath the Gulf of Mexico, an environmental minefield that has been ignored for decades. And neither the industry or the federal government is checking to see whether they are leaking, so says an Associated Press investigation from the beginning of July. The oldest of these wells were abandoned in the late 1940s, raising the prospect that many deteriorating sealing jobs could be failing. The AP investigation uncovered particular concern with 3,500 of these neglected wells, those characterized in federal government reports as temporarily abandoned. And while preparing this next story for this week's show, I realized that by rights it should have been on last week's podcast, but better late than never, I suppose. So I guess that would place it into the category of things I should have said. Yes, it's that old segment I tried to introduce many, many podcasts ago, but like so many other things I start in my life, I somehow never managed to finish. It fell by the wayside, but here's another stab at it. What I neglected to cover, and there's no excuse for it, this sort of story almost never gets covered in the national press, especially on the TV. Last weekend, hundreds of peace activists gathered in Albany for the UNPC, which is the United National Peace Conference. Speakers included Kathy Kelly, coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
We have to become many more than we are now. And one of the ways to do that will be at the grassroots and the nitty-gritty, continuing to build and expand our communities dedicated to looking for ways to take actions commensurate to the crimes being committed. It requires our lives. It requires us to rearrange our priorities to make the number one priority in our everyday life, becoming constant, persistent anti-war activists. What better purpose is there in life right now?
And if you would like to find out more about Kathy Kelly and all the other good folk at Voices for Creative Nonviolence and what they're up to, you can go to their website at vcnv.org. That's vcnv.org. And if you would like to find out what happened at the conference that took place last week, there's a very good blow-by-blow description. I guess that's not really a good metaphor, is it? Let's try that again. There's a very good daily analysis at firedoglake.com, and that can be found at seminal.firedoglake.com/diary/61658. That's seminal.firedoglake.com/diary/61658. Oh, and here's another story that really falls under the same category as the last. So I guess we should keep the grassroots music going. Things I should have said. Yeah, this one is not as uplifting as the last, but it is still a story I should have mentioned on last week's podcast. Well, right-wing TV / multimedia personality and much-quoted and highly respected conservative writer over at the American Spectator, Ben Stein.
Bueller.
Yeah, him. Yeah, that guy. Trashed the suffering of unemployed Americans last week by writing in an article that those who are presently unemployed are, and I quote, generally people with poor work habits and poor personalities, end quote. He said that the current day unemployed are Americans with, quote, unpleasant personalities who do not know how to do a day's work, end quote. What Stein failed to point out in his brilliant article, I guess I'm being too picky. It's such a small point. Probably insignificant. Hardly worth mentioning, really. It is a great article. Just this one point would have just set it off. I might as well mention it. What Ben failed to mention is the fact that this current Republican-generated Great Recession was set into motion by the collective criminal behavior of the world's largest banks and their enablers in Washington, who legalized their massive theft, in essence greasing the skids through deregulation, while all of this being cheered on gleefully by right-wing commentators, well, like Ben Stein. But he sure does have a way with words. Oh, he's a smooth talker. But, you know, obviously saying that the 15 million Americans who are presently unemployed are generally people with poor work habits and poor personalities, well, that's bad enough. But it is as offensive as it is incorrect. Before the recession, the unemployment rate hovered at around 6%. It is now at around 10%, with the real figure being somewhere in the middle teens. It's crazy, to say the least, that millions of Americans suddenly got lazier and less able to work within the span of a few months, is it not?
Bueller. 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 She closed
the door. Unfortunately, as stated at thinkprogress.org, Stein is a widely respected voice on the American right who regularly appears on cable news to offer his thoughts on politics and policy. Using the critical mention media search engine, Think Progress found that this guy's name was mentioned 64 times in major television media networks within the past 30 days alone.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
Stay away, Ferris. You're better off. I wish we all could take a day off. Well, that is it for this extended view of the news here at On the Left. Boy, it was a very newsy week with plenty to cover. And I'd like to thank Matthew for all of this extra time for me to babble and ramble this week. I really appreciate it, Matthew. Thank you. I'd also like to give mention to at least a few of my sources besides the AP and the New York Times and, of course, the Guardian of London. Very good paper. There's this list of great places and great people. There's Amy Goodman at democracynow.org, the Tom Hartman Program at tomhartman.com, Laura Flanders of Grit TV at gritTV.org, Think Progress at thinkprogress.org. This week, of course, WikiLeaks at wikileaks.org, and FAIR, that's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, at fair.org. Free Speech Radio News at fsrn.org, Crooks and Liars at crooksandliars.com, and, of course, BuzzFlash at buzzflash.com for all the latest breaking news. And, hey, be sure to check in with Matthew Seneff at ontheleftpodcast.blogspot.com and his other site at liberalizeamerica.blogspot.com. We have a Facebook fan page. Please search us out. You can find us easily by just keying in the words On the Left Podcast in that Facebook search engine. Come on down. We would love to have you as a fan. Also, please leave a comment, whatever you'd like to say, at iTunes. If you're subscribing to this on iTunes, I hope you are. I hope you are. Anyway, that is it for me. For On the Left Podcast, this has been Michael Carlucci. Thanks again, Matthew, and thank all of you for listening to me.
Hello and welcome to episode 22 of Unless Podcast. This is Matthew Seneft. Thanks, Mike, for one heck of a great headlines this week. Did a fantastic job as usual. Would expect nothing less. One little thing on my opinion, one of the things that really doesn't get picked up much on the WikiLeaks reports is that the mainstream media and the Washington media has really come out and really tried to poo-poo the WikiLeaks scandal and the what was reported there. I think mainly in the mainstream media's, the reason why they don't really care for the story is because it proves that they're not doing their job. And nobody is asking the one important question of the Obama administration, that if these documents are so unimportant, as they've been saying, and they don't tell us any new information, then why were all 90,000 documents classified? Just a continuation of closed government. Now, WikiLeaks has also reported that they have yet another 150,000 documents that they're going through and trying to verify which ones are true and which ones aren't, and to redact some of the names that are in there because, you know, individual soldiers don't need to be implicated in anything. So we can look forward to that coming up from WikiLeaks yet. So one of the things that the one thing I want to talk about this week is, did you know that this last week in Iowa, a very large dam, an 88-year-old dam, was overrun by a flood? And it collapsed. I think that's kind of important. Now, this is a dam that had issues in the past. It had been inspected last year, and it was found that one of its floodgates, one of the gates that goes all the way up when there's large floods to let more water through the dam, was malfunctioning. It would not raise all the way. And, of course, Iowa, being like most states, has a budget deficit, so they decided that they did not want to fix that. So this 9-mile long lake disappeared when this dam broke, flooding 6,000 to 7,000 acres of farmland, destroying as many as 500 houses. Luckily, these weren't houses that people live in all the time. A lot of these were cabins and stuff like that were on this lake. But it goes to show what is important, what we should and shouldn't spend our money on. And the Iowa Republican Party was nice enough this week, while I was looking into all this dam information, to put out their Republican Party platform. So that's what I'm going to kind of get into real quick here. And I want to read a couple of things from their party platform. And this is what Republicans in Iowa believe are important. I will start by reading the preamble. As Republicans, we continue to uphold the principles of individual responsibility, adhere to traditional moral standards, a strong national defense, a free enterprise system, and respect for the sanctity of human life. We believe in retaining the moral absolutes that our founding fathers drew from the Holy Scriptures as the principal foundation for our Constitution. We acknowledge God's blessing on our country and our continued dependence upon God for the preservation of our nation. We believe high moral character is a necessity of public servants. The highest standard of character should be embodied in both public and private life. We encourage the proliferation of these principles and their passage to future generations. Not a very good start for the Republican Party. They got a number of issues wrong there in their little preamble. Our founding fathers did not base the Constitution on the Holy Scriptures, but we'll just let that one slip past here because these are quite a bit nutty. Now, they have this broken up into a bunch of different subcategories. So we're going to start with agriculture. and agriculture is 1.4. This, we support farm programs that allow individual farmers to raise a crop and sell it at a significant profit to eliminate the need for government subsidies. Most farmers get subsidies. I guess they don't want their farmers to get subsidies anymore. So, also under agriculture, we oppose a national animal identification system. So next time there's a mad cow outbreak or some sort of disease going around our beef, the Republicans in Iowa don't want you to be able to track what animals came from what farm. That sounds like great policy to me. We support the definition of manure as a natural fertilizer. Well, they are Republicans. Now I'm going to read you here the heading here under business and economic development. We believe that a welcoming business climate is critical to our state's economic prosperity and to and the development of our natural and human resources. The key to that prosperity is an adequate return on an individual's labor, talent, capital, and risks. We believe that excessive regulation, business fees, and taxes diminish that return. So let's find out what they think is important. Number one on their list under business and economic development, we believe that the focus of OSHA should be working with, not against, business. Well, OSHA is supposed to work for the workers, not the businesses. We believe the marketplace, not the government, should set the minimum wage. That sounds like a really good idea. We believe that landlords should have the same rights as other business owners. Non-payment of rent should be considered a theft of service. We also support landlord rights to refuse leasing property and business owners refusing service based on moral grounds. Ooh, that means that they don't want to have anybody that they don't like. Education. Lots of voucher programs in here. One of my favorites. We believe the displayment of the Ten Commandments, the American flag, and the resuscitation of the Pledge of Allegiance should be allowed. I'm not sure anybody's trying to keep them from saying the Pledge of Allegiance or taking the American flag out of schools. Ten Commandments, that's another thing. We support voluntary teacher and student-led prayer in government schools. The use of the Bible as a textbook should be allowed as local options. Mm-hmm. We support the teaching of alternative theories on the origins of life, including Darwinism, creation science, and intelligent design, and that each should be given equal weight in presentation. How many times do we have to say this? Evolution, Darwinism, is not the origin of life. It's how life evolves. Creationism and intelligent design are the same thing. They are both fiction. One is fact, based up by years and years and years of study, and the other two are based on a book that even the Catholic Church does not recognize who wrote it. Fiction. We believe that educators should stress abstinence outside of marriage as the only way to prevent pregnancy. Another good one. We support getting rid of the Federal Department of Education and the removal of this position from the cabinet. Always a good one. We believe increased funding should not be measured of support for the education in Iowa. Rather, support for policies and curriculum that returns the focus of Iowa K through 12 education to basic academic achievement and appreciation for Western civilization. Not sure what they mean by Western civilization, and that should be measured of excellence in education. And this is one of my favorites under education. We appreciate the contributions of all ethnic groups have had on the American culture. However, we do not support Ethnic History Month in Iowa. Stay classy, Iowa. Oh, let's go on to energy and transportation. They support drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They want to overhaul the current federal system regulations on building new power plants. They oppose the ethanol mandate. There is no ethanol mandate, but that's okay. And they, of course, they want the locks along the Mississippi River to be modernized and lengthened by the federal government. Of course, they don't want to pay for it themselves. Now let's get on to the big issues of the Republican Party. This is under family values. We believe that the basis of our laws and our founding documents are rooted in the Judeo-Christian values. We believe every human being should have the inalienable right to life regardless of age or degree of dependency, including human beings from conception. That doesn't really make much sense, but we believe that the family is the cornerstone of society. A traditional two-parent family of one man and one woman is the best environment to raise children. That's true, if of course both parents are there, one parent's not drunk, the other parent's not beating the kid, you know. But they think it's the best environment. Now, they have six bullet points in this one. I'm going to read all six because they are juicy. We support an amendment to both the state and federal constitution defining marriage as the exclusive union between one man and one woman. We support the elimination of no-fault divorce. I actually like that one. We support adoption by heterosexual married couples only. I guess no gay people get to have kids. We oppose the creation of a protected class based on sexual orientation. We believe that parents are responsible for their children, and we support the rights of parents to discipline, protect, and educate their children. Corporal punishment. Good. Number six. We believe the father of a child, born or unborn, has the same rights and responsibilities as the mother in all matters regarding the child. This, of course, is to fight against Roe versus Wade. Government, we go into now, of course, the preamble for that. They don't want oversized government. They want the oversized government squashes the entrepreneurial spirit, blah, 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 low taxes. So let's hit on a couple of things. We support maintaining the principle of voluntary donors, not tax dollars, to fund the business of sports, entertainment, and the arts. I like that, except for they don't care about the sports part or the entertainment part. All they care about is whether or not the arts gets money. They, of course, support English as the official language of Iowa. I think the British would say that we don't speak English, but that's okay. We support building new prisons as necessary to protect the public from violent criminals. Of course, you know, that does cost money. One of the top ones here. We support proof of citizenship and residency as requirements for voter registration. We believe voters should be required to present a valid picture ID before they're allowed to vote. Are we going to make them pay a tax too, or they have to pay to get in there, you know? You know, that's kind of illegal. This is one of my personal favorites here. We support sunset laws requiring all federal and Iowa agencies to expire automatically after a stated number of years unless renewed by law. This should not, of course, apply to any tax relief law. We assert that the phrase, the separation of church and state as it is commonly used contradicts the original intent and practice of the framers of the Constitution. Yeah, they are one heck of a lovely group of people here in Iowa. Under Health and Human Services, they have a lot in here for some reason about requiring everybody to be tested for AIDS, that goes to prison, that works with prisoners, that works in a hospital. All their names and their test results should go into a giant database which can be looked at by the public. They also heavily believe in this one because it's in this section twice. We believe the vaccination of children and medical decisions are best left to the parents without government coercion. We support mandatory testing of AIDS, HIV, of all healthcare professionals, and the right of patients and their families to access the results of those tested. Now, you want to talk about Big Brother? That's Big Brother right there. Now let's go on to Homeland Security and Immigration. We call for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would prevent the automatic granting of citizenship to children born in the United States whose parents are illegally in this country. And they actually have in parentheses there, anchor babies. Stay classy. And we do not believe the government should reimburse families for the loss of a loved one due to an act of God, natural disaster, or terrorist attack, unless that individual was a member of the armed services. So, I just told you at the beginning of this whole thing that a 88-year-old dam had broken and the lake behind it had spilled out. And if anybody had been killed by that negligence by the Iowa state, they shouldn't get a single penny. Love these people. Way to look out for yourselves. They, of course, we're going to go into law and justice. They, of course, support reinstating the death penalty. We strongly believe the Second Amendment, which guarantees us the right to keep and bear arms without government intervention. Taxpayers' funds should not be used to compensate the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm not sure what that has to do with other than their absolute hatred of actual civil liberties. We support prison reform, including the limitation of prisoner rights and amenities. Convicts should be required to work. Slave labor, I think that's called. They, of course, support the repeal of state and federal hate crimes legislation. Now we go into national defense and foreign policy. They do not want to be part of the United Nations. They don't think we should give any money to the United Nations. And we should not participate in the United Nations. Okay. They, of course, once again state that we support the Second Amendment. We support complete reimbursement of travel expenses for National Guard and reservists while they are on active duty. I got no problem with that. We support development of controls so that foreign governments are never in a position to influence the outcome of an American election. Well, then we better stop letting China buy all of our debt. Their environmental policy is all about farm subsidies, which they say they want to get rid of. One of my favorite parts, family values wasn't bad enough. They actually have a right to life program. We believe human life is a sacred gift from our Creator and is a fundamental right as outlined in the Declaration of Independence. This right is innately valuable in every stage of development, including the unborn and the elderly, the terminally and chronically ill, and the mentally or physically handicapped. No human life should ever be diminished. An innocent human life must never be arbitrarily taken. Well, that's good unless you count your support for war, but the unborn child has a fundamental right to life, which cannot be infringed. I always like these people that call themselves that they have a life, their right to life. But then once the kid's born, they don't seem to care about whether or not the kid actually has 3 meals a day or can survive. They, of course, don't want euthanasia. We support a woman's right to know law whereby performers of abortion must provide complete factual information to a pregnant woman about the complications of abortion, the biological development of the unborn, fetal pain, and the availability of alternatives to abortion. They get that anyways. It's just that these people don't like the fact that they're on the losing end of the science when it comes to that, especially fetal pain. They, of course, don't want any fetal tissue research. They don't want any money going to Planned Parenthood, and they want to overturn Roe versus Wade. Now, of course, their longest part here is on tax and spending. They, of course, don't like any taxes, and they want to continue spending a lot. They, of course, here, big one that leaps out. They want to continue. We believe the Federal Tax Reform Act, the Bush tax cuts of 2003, should be made permanent, which will put a massive hole in our deficit. We support the repeal of the 16th Amendment, the elimination of the IRS, and replacing all federal income taxes with a national consumption tax. Yeah, that's really going to work. But, and one of the things that really struck me in the tax and spend part is the last one in there. It's, we strongly oppose government money being given to AARP. What do they have against the AARP? Now, at the end here, they have a few commendments. Number one on top is, we commend President Bush for his outstanding leadership in the war on terror, for his efforts to strengthen national defense and homeland security, and for his part in renewing a spirit of unity and love for our country. What world do these idiots live in? We demand an end to gender-specific offices in the Republican Party. I'm not sure what that complaint means. We commend all good Republicans for defending Republican principles of government. I'm not sure if there's bad Republicans that they're talking about there. We expect political campaigns to be conducted in a positive and truthful manner. Well, these guys are from Iowa, so I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on that, but the National Republican platform does not give you that. And then we wish to commend the Department of Health and the University of Iowa Neonatal Intensive Care Unit for the outstanding care provided to premature infants. We further recognize that the University of Ohio survival rates of 38%, 69%, and almost 80% for 22, 23, and 24-week premature infants, respectively, are among the best in the nation. Now, if you believe in God's laws and that God's always right, then you shouldn't believe in neonatal intensive care. The child should be able to come out, pull up its poop straps, and be ready to go, just like any good Republican is. I'm just being mean there. That's not really what they believe. They really don't believe anything. They're Republicans. What am I telling you? So, that's my little take on the Iowa Republican Party. I will be posting a link to the PDF on the show notes from this episode. So go check it out and read it yourself. I hit some of the top ones, but boy, there is, under education, there is about 40 things in there that is just complete, and it'll make you laugh out loud that these people think that they're anywhere near the mainstream of the United States. So I would like to thank you for listening. I would like to thank Mike for providing headlines this week. Check out our website, On the Left Podcast, at ontheleftpodcast.blogspot.com. check out my blog site, Liberalize America, at liberalizeamerica.blogspot.com. Check us out on Facebook, On the Left Podcast. Put that up in your search engine. You can drop me an email at ontheleftpodcast@gmail.com. Leave us a review in iTunes, if you'd be so kind. And for Mike Carlici, this has been Matthew Seneft. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you again next week.
I'm going to go with Lieutenant here, Matthew Seneft. Lieutenant Seneft, you rock the world.
That's all, folks.